This is the fourth and final day of this December 2015 four-day session. And I'm going to return to Shengyan, book is Illuminating Silence, compiled by John Crook. And I'm going to start in the middle of a section that's entitled Day 4 Breakfast Table Remarks. And Shengyan says this: to practice with the method is like climbing a high mountain. You can only say the climb is over when you reach the summit. Perhaps you are climbing the mountain in a thick fog or a cloud. From the beginning, you have no idea how high up you are. You may think you have come no way at all, and then suddenly you arrive. You may think you are nearly at the peak, and then you find further slopes rising before you. All you can do is climb. Without climbing, you will get nowhere. In an act of faith, you simply place one foot before the other. If you believe you are getting nowhere, you will become lax and the climb will exhaust you. On retreat, do not set yourselves particular goals for practice. Just keep going in the right direction. Every single step is then an act of reaching the goal. Going on is the goal. The goal is in the going. I think somewhere Aiken Roshi said, our only rest is the rest in our efforts. If you run a race and your mind is on the winning post, you split yourself into now and then. If you forget the goal and just place all your attention on the energy of running, you will suddenly find yourself there. If a climber has his mind focused on the summit, he may easily find the climb exhausting and stop halfway, giving up. Probably everybody has had the experience of sitting in a particularly mind-numbingly boring class and watching the clock slowly tick. Or perhaps you sat on the mat and thought about time. As long as we're looking outside ourselves, looking towards the end of whatever it is we're doing, it's tough. But once we're engaged, once we're fully with it, then time goes by quickly, as I'm sure many people have experienced in Sesshin. It's why the first half of Sesshin is so much longer than the second, for most people, in most cases. In climbing a mountain, sometimes we encounter a steep slope. At other times, we find a flat area to stroll across. The wise climber, you might say the experienced climber, does not take particular notice of these differences. Both the steep slope and the flat area are high in the hills already. Likewise, when we practice, sometimes there arise good conditions and sometimes troublesome ones. If you find yourself in a good place, don't get too happy. There may be a steeper slope just ahead. On the other hand, in difficult times, do not get discouraged. The slope will ease off shortly. On retreat, you cannot predict how one sitting session will be from the previous one. You simply have to sit down and find out. Every sitting is a new birth. Of course, that's true not only in retreat. It's always true. Sit down with a clear mind, no agenda, no expectations. It's the way to do it. When climbing the mountain, you may constantly experience differences in slope, differences in the demands made upon your energy and resilience. This goes on until the summit is reached. Similarly, in retreat, do not be too eager for results. Take up an attitude of going forward without seeking anything. Use the ordinary mind to practice diligently. It's not a special mind. It's our mind. It's the mind that's always been with us. People sometimes feel that all they ever encounter are the steep slopes. They never come across flat areas. What bad luck! Remember, you are indeed tackling a steep mountain. When this is the case, you need to build stronger foundations for your practice. This is something that we can all take to heart. So much that we do in our daily lives outside of Sesshin that makes Sesshin more difficult. Just the habit of indulging trivial thoughts. The habit of chatting to no purpose. The habit of doing idle things that we don't even really enjoy that much, but that just fill up the time. All those things are weakening our foundation. Sesshin and daily life can alternate with one another. If we go to a lot of sesshins, they need to support each other. What we accomplish in sesshin, what we learn, what we see, what we gain, those things need to come out in our daily life. We need to bring them home. And when sesshin ends and we're free to sit when we want, sleep when we want, eat when we want, eat what we want, need to have that foundation. Next section is entitled Day 4 Evening Lecture. And he says, let's continue with Wang Ming's verse. And then the four lines are, to exaggerate clumsiness and covet skill does not lead to great virtue. Of much fame but little contribution, their reputation quickly crumbles. Then he says, many people suffer from feelings of inferiority. Others feel themselves to be very important. They exaggerate their self-respect into aggrandizement. Both of these feelings arise from comparing oneself with others. When you live alone, you find that such feelings arise less frequently. Of course, Sheng Yan himself spent 6 years in a solitary retreat. I do not know how modern psychology analyzes these feelings, but from the viewpoint of the Buddha Dharma, each of these feelings is a different manifestation of the same basic inclination. A person who feels inferior is obviously lacking in confidence, but so is somebody who exaggerates his or her importance and behaves arrogantly. Both inferiority and a sense of superiority come from lack of confidence. Basically, we can say that comparing ourselves to others comes from lack of confidence. Worrying what other people think comes from lack of confidence. You cannot practice well if you lack confidence. You look at others and think of how well they must be getting on. You feel as if nobody else has a problem, as if you are the only one sitting there worried and anxious. Sometimes when I find a practitioner who is troubled in this way, I say, don't be so lacking in confidence. I too came from the same root. When I was young, I also had to endure great difficulties in practice. It was only through hard work and applying the method that eventually I had a tiny bit of understanding. Sometimes such a practitioner says to me, "Shifu, how can I compare myself with you? You are a Chan master, so how can I expect to get the same sort of accomplishment?" Then there is another kind of person, not so common as the first, who will say to me, "Shifu, you are now so old and I am young. By the time I reach your age, I will definitely have surpassed you." This brings to mind an old friend of mine was here at the center back in the early days, the late 60s. We had that first training program. He recounted for me one of his doksans. That's obviously a big no-no, but he wasn't always painting within the lines. He marched into Doksan and sat himself down in front of Roshi Kaplow and announced to him, "I shall become a great yogi." And Roshi Kaplow just went ballistic. He said, "You'll never amount to anything." And he shook the bell and rang him out. Interestingly, when Roshi Kaplow died back in 2004, this friend, I suddenly heard his voice in the hallway outside my office. He had come back, many people did, when they heard about Roshi's death. And I had a chance to catch up with him, and he was a student of Sheng Yen and doing quite well. Not sure that he was a great yogi, but at least he'd kept going. He's one of those students that I think the teacher cannot abuse him enough. So the first of these practitioners is putting him or herself down. There's a feeling of inability and inferiority. The second type is filled with arrogance. "Of course, I shall be very happy if all my disciples surpass me. But when practitioners show either of these attitudes, I am not so happy." That's an interesting point. Any real teacher would be overjoyed to have a disciple who surpasses him. Neither attitude is helpful in practice. In particular, a person who shows his lack of confidence through arrogance has very little chance of making progress so long as he thinks that way. But of course, we can change. However we think, whether our thoughts are self-deprecating or aggrandizing, when we see them and we drop them, then everything shifts. Because people pick up thought patterns and ordinary, normal people often keep them for their entire lives, we get the idea that, well, people just don't change. But they can. They do. We see it in ourselves. The fact that what is determining the way our life runs is our thoughts is, it may be maddening, but it's also very promising. It's very hopeful because we can change them. We can drop them. We can see through them. He says, "Now let me ask you, do you think it is possible to be feeling inferior and behaving in a superior manner at the same time? Have you ever manifested such sentiments? I see by the show of hands that many of us recognize such problems. The fact that we can perceive them is already a sign of progress. If you know you have such weaknesses and yet you still try to cover them up and act as if you were truly confident, then you are like the praying mantis." This must be some Chinese fable. There is a fable in which the mantis saw a carriage rolling towards it. It raised one of its legs to stop the carriage. Actually, it knew very well that such a thing was impossible, but nonetheless it wanted to put on a show. The mantis is actually very pitiable. Such a pretense of ability is simply a manifestation of self-centeredness. Of course, there are also people who never try to resolve difficulties. They like to evade a difficult situation as much as possible. Such a person is like the ostrich. sticking its head in the sand and hoping the lion will go away. The trouble is that all of us are mantises and ostriches by turns, and we remain thereby in delusion. In the Orient, many people are like this. Perhaps it is the same in the West. Have you not met the man who is approaching 30 and begins to lose his hair? So, in case others should notice, he begins combing his hair in such a way that the hair on the left side goes over to the right. Is anybody else picturing Donald Trump? Yet anyone who really takes a look can see at once that he is bald in the center. Of course, if you are a Chan practitioner and you are bald in the center, well, you are bald in the center. My son had a friend who went bald early and solved it in the approved method. He just cut his hair short. He said his haircut was bald with dignity. A Chan practitioner needs to have this self-knowledge. He should know what sort of appearance he has and feel at home in it. In whatever situation, you should know how far your ability will carry you. With the ability, you act. Without it, you do not. No fuss, no pretense. This is the message you hear in AA, coming to just feel comfortable in our own skin. So much of our discomfort, awkwardness, comes from worrying about how we appear to others. But we are what we are. John Tarrant, the Zen teacher, said, "We are all flowers. Our job is just to bloom, to blossom. What sort of flower is none of our business." When I came to this retreat, I knew that many of you were well educated with degrees in psychology and other subjects. I did not think about it very much or trouble to look up these subjects in books and prepare myself for questions about this or that. I did not prepare myself at all, in fact. I just came over. Here I am. I can tell you what I know. If there are things I cannot answer, so what? We can still talk together. The important thing is to recognize ourselves for what we are. Just recognize whatever you are, whatever abilities or inabilities you have, and accept yourself. There's no need to get vexed over comparisons. If you can manage this, you will become firm in character, more healthy, and at peace. Skipping ahead, day 5, early morning talk. Today there are two important phrases for you to bear in mind. These are ordinary mind, wanting nothing. So those two, ordinary mind, wanting nothing. He says, the unbiased content of the ordinary state of mind is both natural and everlasting. To be natural, the mind needs to be free from anything artificially created by thought or reasoning, from anything shaped by an experience or judgment. When these things are absent, we say the mind is in its natural state. When the mind is natural, it is in conformity with the Tao. Let me put it this way. Here in the mountains, in this old farmhouse of stone and wood, we are living close to nature, yet the tools we use and the clock that tells the time remain man-made. They are not completely natural, but for us, the use of such simple tools is natural enough. It is of our nature to use such things. To wear clothes is natural, and we feel comfortable. To take them off would be uncomfortable and would not be natural for us, even if at first sight, nakedness might be nearer our original condition. Natural is what is appropriate. Natural is this. When there is one, there is one. When there are two, there are two. Things are as they are. We do not need to add criteria of evaluation to fit our moods, thoughts, or judgments. Whatever is truly natural is everlasting. I mean to say the natural forms part of a timeless process that obeys unchanging principles. The sunlight from the window moves as a patch across the floor. It comes and goes as the clouds move across the sky. The sun itself follows its own varying path relative to the earth. The earth revolves on its axis, so we have the experience of the sunrise in the morning and the sunset in the evening. The patch of light on the floor appears according to the rules of place, time, and weather. All this is natural and everlasting. Water becomes rain, and rain becomes water. This, too, is everlasting. It is of the eternal. In the practice of Chan, it is important to discover and to maintain the natural basis of the mind. If a practitioner remains with his illusory thoughts, his mind is split. It does not come to rest in the natural state. Without discovering the natural basis, the practitioner sooner or later abandons his quest. He has not hit upon the eternal. Once the eternal is perceived, the practitioner is unlikely to give up, for he has discovered his own basis. I want to read here. A pertinent section from this Anthony DeMello fellow that I mentioned in a previous talk. Since this is the second time I've gone to him, maybe I'll say the book this is coming from. It's called Awareness, The Perils and Opportunities of Reality, Anthony DeMello. It's basically a transcription of talks that he gave. He was an Indian. He was born in Goa. In India, a small little former Portuguese colony, which was converted by means of the sword, of course, to Christianity in the 1400s. So he grew up in a Catholic family and he became a priest. He was a Jesuit priest. Not a normal one. He says, "Did it ever occur to you that you could be happy in tension? Before enlightenment, I used to be depressed. After enlightenment, I continue to be depressed. You don't make a goal out of relaxation and sensitivity. Have you ever heard of people who get tense trying to relax? If one is tense, one simply observes one's tension. You will never understand yourself if you seek to change yourself. The harder you try to change yourself, the worse it gets. You are called upon to be aware. Get the feel of that jangling telephone. Get the feel of jarred nerves. Get the sensation of the steering wheel in the car. In other words, come to reality and let tension or the calmness take care of itself. As a matter of fact, you will have to let them take care of themselves because you'll be too preoccupied with getting in touch with reality." It's the whole method behind the madness of koan practice. "Step by step, let whatever happens happen. Real change will come when it is brought about not by your ego, but by reality. Awareness releases reality to change you. In awareness, you change, but you've got to experience it. At this point, you're just taking my word for it. Perhaps also you've got a plan to become aware. Your ego, in its own cunning way, is trying to push you into awareness. Watch it. You'll meet with resistance. There will be trouble. When someone is anxious about being aware all the time, you can spot the mild anxiety. They want to be awake. To find out if they're really awake or not. That's part of asceticism, not awareness. It sounds strange in a culture where we've been trained to achieve goals to get somewhere, but in fact, there's nowhere to go because you're there already. The Japanese have a nice way of putting it. The day you cease to travel, you will have arrived. Your attitude should be, I want to be aware, I want to be in touch with whatever is, and let whatever happens happen. If I'm awake, fine. And if I'm asleep, fine. The moment you make a goal out of it and attempt to get it, you're seeking ego glorification, ego promotion. You want the good feeling that you've made it. I wonder if anyone can relate to this. When you do make it, you won't know. Your left hand won't know what your right hand is doing. Lord, when did we do this? We had no awareness. Dogen said, you find it when you're halfway. If you find you've gone all the way, keep going. Back to Sheng Yin here. When we are born, the body-mind is in its natural state. Gradually, we adopt unnatural contortions, defending ourselves where, if we were wise, we would find that no defense is needed. The practice of Chan enables us to go back to being natural, to rediscover the eternal quality of being. Every day we get up, wake, wash, eat, go to the toilet. All this is natural. Similarly, we need to build into our everyday lives the practice of meditation. Let it be a natural part of daily life, not something special with a time set aside for it, but a quality of ongoing awareness. Of course, it may help to have a time set aside for meditation, but the point is valid. Meditation, zazen, shouldn't be a special activity. It's what we do. It's natural. Always say that trying to establish a daily practice of zazen is similar to getting into the habit of brushing your teeth. For me, it was flossing my teeth. I had a long pattern of cavities, one after another, every time I went, we'd find one or two more. And finally, my dentist told me what I needed to do, and it took me quite a while to get it established. There's a whole routine of flossing and special toothpaste, and takes about 8 or 10 minutes. Took a while to get used to it, but once it's there, once the pattern is established, you don't even have to think about it anymore. It doesn't require an exercise of willpower. And it's the same with a sitting practice. Once sitting is something that you do, you always do, then how much effort is there to get on the mat? Wake up and there we go. Our life is built up of little habits and patterns, and it makes a huge difference which ones we establish. We establish them just through passivity, going with the flow, the easiest thing to do. Often our habits become our biggest obstruction. But they can also be a huge support, a foundation. When we look at the stream outside, we see the water flowing. What is its purpose? There is no purpose. It is simply flowing. So let it be with practice. Practice itself has no particular purpose. If you give practice a purpose, then it's not natural practice. It is not rooted in the eternal. When your practice has no purpose, when practice itself is the purpose, then it is natural practice. Only this natural practice has the quality we call everlasting. We practice because what else would we do? When your practice has no purpose, you are not seeking anything, by definition. You want nothing. When you want nothing and there is nothing to want, What is there then? Please just use an ordinary state of mind to practice. No need for assumptions, moods, emotions, judgments. Simply follow your method. Work hard for no reason. Sit without any purpose in your sitting. Let the natural state arise everlastingly. The attitude we need to adopt in the practice of Chan is different from the attitude we take when doing work of other kinds, such as an academic study. Not only is it different, it should be quite the opposite. Usually when we're involved in a task that needs discipline or study, we like to get on with the job to get things done fast. If we hurry and get a move on, then we can get done as much as possible. If we hurry and work hard, then the result is usually proportional. On the other hand, if you take a hurrying attitude in the practice of Chan, you may achieve merely an undesirable result. The more you try to hurry in calming your mind, the more obstacles you will generate. The more you hurry to get enlightenment, the more vexations you will create, and you will be further away from your goal. The practice of Chan involves training in patience, in determination. It requires a development of the will. The purpose of practice is to free ourselves from the self, to go beyond attachments to the self. If we are seeking rapid results, seeking to gratify ourselves in reaching some goal or some attainment, then this is the opposite of the purpose of Chan. If we get anxious because there appears to be no result from practice, we are making a mistake. In Chan, trying to make progress ensures no progress. Let us return once more to the analogy of the feather and the fan. Before you can get any result from your practice, you have to hold the fan in a very stable and peaceful manner. And if the feather does end up on your fan, it is important not to get excited. If you get too happy, there will be a slight stir of your hand and the feather will be gone. The question is, when will the feather drop on your fan and never fly away again? As long as there is an idea of attainment in which you imagine something and want it, the feather will keep floating away. In fact, the problem will last just as long as the feather and the fan exist for you. Only when there is no person seeking an attainment and no attainment to be realized will the ultimate solution arise. That's a pretty advanced state, isn't it? And although we say Zazen has no purpose, practice should have no purpose, in another sense there is. Why are we doing this? It's just that when we carry that into our Zazen, when we preoccupy ourselves with how we're doing, when we measure it, then we're not doing Zazen. It is through thinking that we decided to come to this Sesshin, but it isn't through thinking that we're going to do this Sesshin. It helps to see this. It helps to see how our anxiety, our striving, gets in the way. It helps to be okay with how we are. To have confidence, both in ourselves and in the practice, in the method. Have the willingness to let things unfold. Have the willingness to have the mountain be steep, conditions difficult. Somebody said today, they're stubborn. That's excellent. Just to be, just to keep going. Just to keep going. It's, in a way, it's wonderful that practice doesn't require all the contortions that we want to bring to it. It doesn't require intense tension. It does require intense focus. It does require intense dedication. But we don't have to do anything unnatural. And we don't have to be the stage director. We don't have to decide, these are the areas I want to improve in, and this is what I'm going to do, and here's what I'll accomplish in this session, or else it's a failure. It's the reason we take the refuges. Put my faith in Buddha. Put my faith in Dharma. Put my faith in Sangha. I do my part, one foot in front of the other. When this gets into our bones, then there's joy in practice. Sesshin is the most wonderful thing in the world. Just have to do it. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.